My name is Justin Gage, and you're tuned in to the Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions Podcast with your host, Jason Woodbury.
Hello and welcome back to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I'm very excited to share this week's chat. On Saturday, April 20th, AD Transmissions returned to the esoteric grounds of the Philosophical Research Society in Los Angeles for a live taping with guest host Will Sheff of Okkervil River, who's been on this show in the past, in conversation with author Sean Howe, discussing his great book Agents of Chaos, Thomas King Forsaad, High Times, and the Paranoid End of the 1970s. Book on High Times founder, provocateur, and trickster Thomas King Forsaad as part of PRS's Earth Day celebration Plant Stock. I'm such a big fan of PRS, that's where we recorded a great talk with Matt Marble about the esoteric influences of Arthur Russell last fall. It's a place that invites inquiry and rewards curiosity and revels in the beauty of the unknown, which makes it a perfect setting for this talk. Agents of Chaos is like a time machine that transports the reader directly back to the chaotic, funky-smelling center of the paranoid 70s, and it required almost a decade worth of sleuthing from Howe. In it, he details the true story of Thomas King Forsaad, the mysterious founder of High Times magazine, cannabis kingpin, El Supremo of the underground press syndicate, yippie agitator, known drug smuggler, and possible CIA spook. For this very special live recording, the great Will Sheff sat down with Sean, and I'm so pleased to share this one with you, so let's let it roll. Here is Sean and Will in conversation as part of PRS's Plant Stock. I'll speak a little bit more with you on the other side. Thanks so much for tuning in to Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I'm really excited for this talk.
All right. Yeah, so excited to be doing this this podcast taping for Aquarium Drunkard about Sean's wonderful book, Agents of Chaos, which is a story about a fellow named Thomas King Forsaad. And I want to start with the absolute laziest question, which in this case turns out to be the most difficult question to answer and kind of the impetus for the whole book. And so that would be, so who was Thomas King Forsaad?
Good question. So if you look up Thomas King Forsaad on the internet, you will find right away that he was the founder of High Times magazine, which first published 50 years ago next month. And then if you dig a little deeper, you'll find a lot of contradictory information. What is certain is that in 1967, he called up, this guy called up the Underground Press Syndicate.
How old was he at this point?
He would have been 22.
Yeah.
The Underground Press Syndicate was this like consortium of underground papers. There was like the Los Angeles Free Press here, the East Village Other, Berkeley Barb, and they were these leftist leaning, weed embracing hippie papers. They had sort of decided to call themselves the Underground Press Syndicate. I think at the time there were maybe a dozen of these papers to give the impression that they were this formidable. This force that was going to kind of overtake America. It was also advantageous to share their content, as we would say today. They freely shared newspaper articles with one another, got the word out about various like hippie things, I guess. Tom Forsaad calls up in 1967 and says, "I want to help." That was not his real name. He was his real name was Gary Goodson. He was a business school graduate in Phoenix, and he had seen that there was a wide open field in kind of like the hippie lifestyle sellout arena. Yeah. So he insinuated himself into the underground press, and in about 2 years he had become the major domo. And so I think the best way to understand him is as an opportunist who mm-hmm. eventually became an idealist.
But there was another side to him too. I mean, there's sort of turned out to be several Thomas King Forsades. It sort of happened. And I remember, you know, I remember you sitting down, and we went out to drinks at a bar in Flatbush Avenue, and, you know, what's up with you? What are you working on? And you had just published your book about Marvel Comics, The Untold Story, and you were sort of like pondering next projects and saying, you know, I think I'm going to write this book about this guy who was involved in High Times magazine. And I said, that's cool. That sounds like a cool book. And that was like a decade ago.
Yeah.
So what happened there that sort of caused that long pause?
Yeah. So I had worked on this Marvel Comics book, and it was like a 75-year history of a company, and it took me 2.5 years, and I thought, oh my God, that's a long time. I better do something that's easier. I thought, oh, this is a really interesting guy, this founder of High Times magazine. And one thing that I did not mention before is there was a rumor that he was a government agent. Yeah. I sort of buried the lead there.
Yeah.
So I thought I'll just like dig into that. I'll do some FOIA requests. I will do this interesting character study, and I'll spend a couple of years on it. The acquiring of government files was not so easy. In fact, I still have not acquired any DEA files, although I know that they existed at some point. I tried to, you know, of course, the first thing you want to do if you're writing a biography of someone is you talk to the people who knew them. I got a lot of people hanging up on me. I would call someone, and you know, they might have like a different name. You know, the people who ran in his circles were themselves pretty mysterious. So yeah. I might spend quite a bit of time just like getting their real name, finding a phone number. And then I would think, okay, you know, bring on the good stories. And I would get responses like, you know, those who know don't talk, and those who talk don't know. And I think you should walk away from this. So I eventually built up like a bit of a character profile about this guy from the people who would talk to me, but there just remained so many unanswered questions about him for a long time.
You had one guy say something rather colorful to you who is involved in some Forsades criminal exploits.
Yeah.
Do you want to share what that was?
Yeah. So there were actually three people tried to write a book about Tom Forsade before I did. One of them was Albert Goldman, who people know as like the author of sort of sensational John Lennon and Lenny Bruce books. Another person had tried to write a book about him, and his ex-wife burned all his research papers. So there was a feeling of a little bit of a curse.
Yeah.
So I called this one guy, and he said, "How did you find me?" I said, I just looked you up on the internet. He said, I don't believe you. He said, I told Albert Goldman when he called, I would cut off his balls and feed them to him. And so I I ended the call pretty quickly, and I got kind of spooked because, as I later learned from this guy, this guy Tim, I'll call him. One of the adventures he had with Forsad was kidnapping another drug dealer. They kidnapped him. They sort of showed him some chains in a corner of a room, and then Forsad started mixing cement, and they were like, "We're going to take you out and drop you in the river." So I took this guy very seriously.
Yeah,
I guess is what I'm saying.
Yeah. What turned things around? Because I got to this point with you and the book. And I didn't want to say this because I knew that you were... I kind of watched your mood just go down and down and down.
Yeah.
And I remember saying to like Beth, my partner, I'm really... I'm kind of worried about Sean. I think this... I started to hate this guy. I was like, this Tom Forsad fucking guy is torturing him from beyond the grave somehow. You know, like it's the monkey paw kind of situation. And I kind of stopped asking you about it. And then I remember at one point you were like, well, I'm getting to the end. So what turned it around?
I think I honestly had to embrace a little bit just the idea that I wasn't going to get to the center of this story. I mean, you know, what happened is as I started researching Tom Forsad, I brought in all these kind of tangential avenues of research. And so I started thinking, oh, I've got to understand, you know, the anti-war movement of the 60s. I've got to understand how smuggling works worked, you know, in the 1970s. I've got to understand, you know, the story behind the magazine, the way various radical groups factionalized. I kind of felt like, oh, I need to be an expert on all of these things. Yeah. But then there was still this kind of like center, this hole in the story.
Yeah.
Because... I mean, Forsad not only, you know, was part of these stories, but he was also involved in a lot of. He was in a big First Amendment battle. He was trying to get White House press credentials, and then this turned into his case became precedent for when Jim Acosta, CNN couldn't get in to the White House under Trump. Forsad's case was like the precedent. Where they had to give a reason why they wouldn't let Acosta in. So Jim Acosta got press credentials because of Tom Forsad.
Wow.
Yeah. Little trivia. But these are the kinds, there's like a million of these little tidbits, you know. He was involved in the punk rock movement. So I guess I sort of just, you know, you kind of like have a portrait of someone by the like the silhouette, the negative.
Yeah.
Cut out, and there was a lot of negativity around him. A lot of, you know, he was a self mythologizer. So we just saw this Captain
Good Vibes. Good Vibes.
Tom Forsad's nickname among his friends was Captain Bad Vibes. So it was not only someone who was a little bit. Obscured. It was someone who had worked very hard to bury all of his tracks.
Yeah, there's even parts of the book where you talk about him appearing in public where it's like his it looks like maybe his mustache is fake.
right. His girlfriend brings him to meet her mother, and the mother tries to like pull the mustache off, and she says to her daughter, "I think he's a cop."
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what's your opinion on that? Do you think he was a sort of secretly, you know, because that's part of the thing that's really great about the book. You talk about this sort of the portrait via silhouette. It is about Tom King Forsad, but it's also about the 70s, and it's about the kind of paranoid stew of the ever more rarefied political protest groups that were coming from like. Really great places, but we're kind of becoming like, you know, the yippies aren't radical enough, so we need the zippies. And there's a lot of, and Forsad was very much involved in that. He was involved in sort of aggressively nonsensical protest acts, like pieing people, throwing pies into people's faces and things like that. Then on the other side, you have this the most fevered, paranoid version of what was going on with the government, where the CIA literally was spying on people. And you had programs like COINTELPRO and programs that were like trying to plant double agents in organizations to turn them against each other. You had flyers out accusing people of not being radical enough that were actually secretly published by the government. Right. And so there would be a lot of basis to, you know, it wouldn't be, it was just kind of good sense to be paranoid in a sense.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. One of the real successes of the US government in the 1960s was engendering this paranoia. It wasn't just that they were spying on people. It was that they were letting people know that they were being spied on. There was the idea, you know, we're going to make everyone think that there's a spy, behind every mailbox.
Yeah.
And you know, there was, I guess it was 71 was when people started to learn about COINTELPRO.
Yeah.
And, you know, being armed with that knowledge is great, but also like once you know that there's an extensive government program, it gets pretty scary. And so, that just accelerated a lot of the factionalism on the left. Farsad himself was accelerating the factionalism by, you know, for instance, calling Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman sellouts. Farsad had edited some of Steal This Book, Abby Hoffman's famous, like, you know, how to rip off free food and Bible. Farsad had edited some of this book, and then he felt like he wasn't paid enough for his help. So he took Abby Hoffman to like a People's Tribunal, hippie court. And so that made like the New York Times that, you know, this idea that Abby Hoffman was gypping other people in the movement. I guess we don't say gyp anymore.
Yeah.
Sorry.
It's all right.
Farsad was very happy to play the role of provocateur,
yeah,
in a way, small p provocateur.
Yeah.
But that led to a lot of people claiming and believing to their deaths that he was working for the government himself.
That's one of the most dispiriting parts of the book. Walks this really interesting line between sort of evoking this really wonderful idealism of that time and then the 1960s going into the 70s and this sort of new experiments in living, new experiments in consciousness, new experiments in press. And it also walks you through this sort of dispiriting parade of ever more outrageous stunts that Farsad pulls sort of to settle slightly obscure personal vendettas,
yeah,
that become increasingly incoherent to people,
yeah,
who are even one degree removed from what the hell is going on.
Right, right. So if people know who the Yippies were, that was like Abby Hoffman and Jerry Rubin, and they were very much pranksters, and they had these stunts that they would pull political commentary by, you know, like on Wall Street, they would go to the floor of the stock market and eat dollar bills or burn dollar bills. Farsad formed the Zippies to basically work, like to say, like, we are the true radicals. We are purer.
Outflank them from the left to some degree.
Outflank them from the left. And so in the 1972 the political conventions, the Zippies were like encamped and picking fights with not only the Yippies, but also like Vietnam veterans against the war. Like people, why would you pick fights against the Vietnam veterans in the war? So it was just, it was they became this kind of maddening symbol of just pests, really.
And I think a lot of the people who knew Forsaad as this hardcore left-wing provocateur didn't know him as a drug smuggler.
Yeah.
And a lot of his criminal buddies weren't really very familiar with the political end of things. And so that's what I was getting at when I was saying that there were sort of multiple Forsaads. Because the great irony of this is that he kind of was one of the pioneering countercultural capitalists.
Yeah, right. I mean, High Times is a very complex symbol of almost the corporatization of drug culture in a sense. But yeah, I mean, one of the reasons that it's sometimes hard to just talk about who is Tom Forsaad is because he compartmentalized his life into so many different divisions. There was the underground press guy who was like a First Amendment hero, and then there was the drug smuggler, and then there was
Then there was Gary Goodson. The Mormon. Was he a Mormon or something like that originally?
He was not a Mormon. He went to the University of Utah.
Yeah,
and he hung out with a lot of Mormons.
Okay,
but you know, I talked to a lot of people who would consider themselves to be close friends of his, and they would not know the other people who considered themselves to be close friends, even though they knew him at the same time, would swear to me like I knew him better than anyone. It was like they were never allowed to be in the same room as the other friends. A lot of arousing of suspicion there.
How did the drug smuggling, because it became a pretty serious operation with planes and, you know, all of this stuff. How did that where did that come from? Where did that grow out of? What were his first sort of like forays into that part of the criminal part of his life?
Yeah. There's a lot of, as I said, there's a lot of myth making. A lot of people have said that he was flying planes in Arizona when he was like in his 20s. He was in the Air National Guard. That's true. I talked to other people who were in the Air National Guard with him. They said he was basically pushing paper. He wasn't even flying a plane. I do know that by the early 70s, he was working with people who had, there was this whole class of people who were kind of soldiers of fortune, maybe involved in Bay of Pigs, who were moving a lot of weight for the government. And by that, I don't mean that they were totally sanctioned by the CIA, but there were enough layers of undercover work that they were protected by the government. And Forsaad was dealing with some of these people.
Mm.
As I'm hearing the way that I'm saying, I mean, it sounds, this is how I became like paranoid over those years. And I started thinking, oh my God, the person I just spoke to who threatened me, like, should I be serious about this?
Yeah.
And I became one of those people who like can tie everything back to like, you know, the JFK assassination.
Yeah.
So there's that smuggling world that he was involved in. There are some really crazy characters in the book who seem to have like, you know, popped up everywhere from like World War II paratroopers to like the attempted assassination of Larry Flint. And I became one of those guys who, like, you know, has the wall, the crazy wall. So I found, you know, some correspondence that showed me that Forsaad was dealing with some of these very scary individuals at one time, and I couldn't I couldn't quite tie things together as much as I wanted to.
Yeah.
And so that took a little while too.
Putting your music up online is not always the easiest thing in the world to figure out, but DistroKid makes music distribution fun and easy with unlimited uploads, and as an artist, you keep 100% of your royalties and earnings. 1 million+ artists rely on DistroKid to get their music into Spotify, Apple Music, YouTube, TikTok, Tidal, Instagram, all the major streaming services. You can use it to edit your lyrics and your song credits. So important in the internet age to let people know the kind of people you're collaborating with. And DistroKid makes that easy. You can also see all your stats from the streamers and, of course, add a credit card to purchase album extras. The DistroKid app is available now on iOS and Android. Go to the app or Play Store to download it.
Well, that's one of the things that's so cool about the book is it dunks you into this chaotic world. And I had to be careful about reading it in certain contexts. Like if I was having a stressful day or when the political situation, which is always kind of at this intolerable boiling point, was like especially like skeeving me out that day, I was like, God, I gotta maybe not read, like put Agents of Chaos on the table for now, because like it starts to get in your brain.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing about the book is that, you know, we live in a world where it feels like the wheels are coming off the wagon.
Yeah.
And there's a temptation to think that that's novel, that this has never happened before. I think that there's a lot of argument to be made that exactly what we're seeing hasn't happened in exactly the same way that we are seeing it now. But this book paints an image of the 70s, of America in the 70s, that is just batshit insane. And it makes you realize, in a weird way, it's kind of comforting because you see some of the things about it that are crazier than now.
Yeah.
And you feel like there's a little bit more stability. And you also see some of the things in it that are eerie rhymes of now. And so you think, oh, well, there have been other crazy times in the world. And there's also an element to it that is sad because it feels like that kind of robust counterculture that was united in some way, at least for a moment, is something that feels sometimes like the very thing that we're losing now.
Mm-hmm.
Because it feels like everything has become so sort of corporatized and there you've got all these sort of like everything gets funneled through Instagram or through Facebook or through Google. And, you know, one of the things that is very inspiring is the idea of an underground press syndicate, like a truly, you know, independent way to disseminate these stories that nobody else would be talking about. And I guess that leads into my question of like, what do you feel like are lessons, you know, given the nature of plant stock and the sort of inherent optimism in the idea of a festival like this?
Yeah.
What are there elements from the world of Thomas King Forsaad and his associates that you feel like are inspiring or cast an interesting light on our moment now or on some future path?
Yeah. Well, I think, you know, the book kind of opens at the end of the 60s. And so a lot of it is kind of about the falling apart of that kind of Aquarian dream. So there's not a whole lot of the optimism of the early hippie days. But I think, I think a lot of the lessons, again, are just, they're almost like by negative example, unfortunately. It's watching these people who should be allies consistently like burning bridges with one another. And I think, there's, as entertaining as the Zippies were, they were, just, they were like Twitter. They were constantly, going for the most outrageous statements and allowing for like zero nuance. Bad vibes indeed.
Yeah. I mean, this is this whole strain of thought about the 1960s that it's interesting to think about sometimes, which is like, to some degree, perhaps there was a, too much too soon quality where, first of all, some of this really heady stuff, plant medicines that people didn't know about before, the sort of youth culture and the rock and roll and like the excitement of that and new ways of living, new ways of loving, new ways of organizing your personal world, fell on a generation that were still very much like children of the 1950s. And, and they didn't really have, maybe they weren't quite ready to sort of do it in a more nuanced way. And there was a certain group of a very hard conservative element that got the shit scared out of them by this point. And they were just kind of like waiting in the wings to come along and make sure that this was kind of never going to happen again.
Yeah. I think certainly, working on this book made me very sympathetic to the mistakes of the boomer generation. It's very easy to look in the rearview mirror and see kind of as the 70s progressed, there's the almost cliche story of the kind of hippies selling out and becoming part of this more commodified world. And in 1978, when Forsad killed himself, which spoiler alert.
Yeah. We have been talking about it in the present tense, so you knew it wasn't going to end well.
Right. Right.
Past.
1978 really was felt like the end of that optimistic dream in a way. He killed himself the same weekend as Jonestown.
Yeah.
And I think the same week as Harvey Milk's assassination. And I think a couple weeks later, Newt Gingrich came into office in Congress. The path to legalization of marijuana also seemed like it was very, like it was inevitable.
That's a mind blower in the book that was a thing I totally didn't realize, which is that we came very close to marijuana being legalized far earlier than it became, in some states.
Yeah, like 1975, 76, 77, like they were decriminalizing left and right in different states. And then what happened in 1978, Jimmy Carter's drug czar was allegedly caught snorting cocaine with High Times employees and was given the heave-ho, and the drug policies really started to shift. And then obviously, Reagan came in office in 81. Yeah. And then it was decades before legalization seemed like it was going to happen.
I do think you're right. It's really glib and easy to go, oh God, these boomers, like they blew it. But, it's like when you look at a path in a field that's completely overgrown with weeds, and there's like somebody took a machete and they went through And it's just like, God, that looks terrible. Then a bunch of people follow the path and they tamp it down. And you're like, now that's a path. Yeah. You know what I mean? But the person who was originally doing didn't know what they were doing. They were just striking out and into the unknown and doing the best that they could. But I do think that the thing that I take away from it the most is there was just so much youth energy and so many people coming from such a good place, even people who were deeply flawed, like Thomas King Forsaad.
Yeah.
And the shame of it was that they couldn't be the United Syndicate. You know, they couldn't fully unite in the way that, you know, that could have given them more power. There right. was a fractiousness.
Right.
And a certain amount of that had to do with, you know, Thomas King Forsaad was a self-mythologizer. He was also a guy who wanted to be hidden. You know, his name wasn't even on the masthead of High Times.
Right.
You know, the El Supremo himself was nowhere to be seen.
Right.
But when you start making things about your myth, you stop to some degree thinking about the collective.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, and High Times, like I said, is really there's a whole bundle of contradictions in, you know, what High Times was. It was, you know, one of the reasons that it was formed was to kind of subsidize the dying underground press, you know, of the early 70s. They thought we'll make a lot of money with this magazine about weed and we'll keep some of these papers afloat. And then later on, you know, there was a trust that was formed so that the employees would get the magazine. So there were these ideals that were very real. I mean, worker equity for this magazine, you know, and at the same time, I think that nothing really contributed more to the kind of commodification of marijuana than High Times did.
It's so interesting to think about the way that marijuana and politics went hand in hand. Marijuana and left-wing politics, you know, went and sort of insurgent leftist politics went hand in hand in that time.
Yeah.
They've been decoupled fully now.
Yeah.
And to the point where, you know, you've got like, you know, Lauren Boebert getting high at Beetlejuice. You know what I mean? It's like not a, yeah. There's not a political element to it anymore.
Right.
Although, you know, as there's still a lot of political power and justice to be found in, for example, like freeing people who have been imprisoned for marijuana offenses
right.
and stuff like that.
Right. Marijuana policy is itself sort of a political thing, but I think, you know, the act of consuming it is no longer considered political. It's just it used to be thought that like, oh, this will like break down your, you know, your thoughts in just sort of blindly following the system, and
yeah.
this will make you question, you know, a lot that's wrong with the world. And now it's kind of like, you know, it's just another party drug.
This is one of the things that I worry about with psilocybin, is that a lot of these, you know, particularly when it comes to like entheogens, these are things that come from a cultural context, and there's a set and setting that is taken very seriously. And when you decouple anything from the original context, whether it's a plant medicine or whether it's art, you know, you can take sacred devotional art and decouple it from its worship context, and it just becomes like a cool pattern that you can look at on an Instagram account that, you know, reposts that kind of stuff. It's an inevitable byproduct of our sort of consumerist society that kind of has a tendency to shuck off the meaning out of things and just present the thing themselves. But I mean, people used to think like, oh, if everybody would just go on a LSD trip, then there would be no war.
Right.
You know, but I think the step that gets skipped there is a respect for these actual things in and of themselves. And because, you know, I just see this vision of legalized psilocybin, you know, and all the money flowing to like venture capitalists and like a nice branded package. And it's just sort of a party drug.
Yeah.
And it's there's something almost obscene about it in a weird way. But I don't think that Tom Forsaad meant, like, he participated in something kind of like that. But I don't think, like you say, I don't think he saw the crass sort of end point of how it could have ended up when he was starting out with High Times.
Right, right. I think I also, you know, I one thing I didn't mention that he also was kind of a pioneer and was, he had something that's very similar to today's dispensary. He had a this very like sterile all white apartment that, you know, people would sit in booths and they would sample wares and then they would, you know, they would purchase the weed. It was very important that, though, in Forsaad's design, like no customers would see each other. So there was, it had the sterility of today's dispensary, but perhaps even more of an illegality to it. I don't think I answered your.
No, I mean, I don't even know if what I was saying was a question, but it's one of those things. It's one of those funhouse mirror moments where you see, oh well, we almost legalized marijuana. We had dispensaries, yeah. You know, before the dispensary was such a thing. Another one that's not in the book, but like how close a universal basic income, how close we came to having that under Nixon is like a mind-blowing thing to me.
Yeah.
But just these weird things that you see about the past that you wouldn't expect. Speaking of the past, on the present tip, let's say where do you see Thomas King Forsaad if he had stuck around? What do you think he would be doing today?
It's impossible to know because the people, like I said, the people who knew him well, the range of predictions that they gave, you know, that they volunteered to me, was pretty vast. His first wife told me that she saw him like a Donald Trump, type figure. He would have turned into something like that. Several people thought that he would be like a Steve Jobs. He would have been kind of like the underground press syndicate was, in a sense, kind of a proto internet. You know, it was.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, intergalactic, this massive network. I think he was bipolar.
So yeah, I mean, it's tough to know because you think, what if this guy could actually have been on more of an even keel?
Yeah, I mean, there's that, and you know, there's also just trying to be decisive about like what his motives were is so difficult for me, even after all this time. So to extrapolate from, you know, his many personas. It seems impossible.
Did you feel like whenever I've had to work on one of these things, I start to feel very close to the person,
yeah.
Even though I don't know them, and yeah. Especially a mystery guy like that. But you start to feel a certain a combination of like ownership and affection, and like you build a virtual model of them in your head, and you might even have conversations with it. I mean, did you start to feel? Coming out of this, how do you feel about Thomas King Forsaad, like in your own life?
Yeah, I feel a certain warmth toward this person who, had I met him, may have been very, very unkind.
He might have started mixing up the cement and the chains.
He might have, yeah. But I think, you know, in his more tender moments, you know, I print a poem that he wrote while on acid, in the book, and there's something that's just so innocently endearing about it, in a way that does not track with, you know, many of the conversations that he had with people. You know, he was very protective and very closed off in so many ways. But I think, I think I've started to sort of see like the little kid inside him.
That's so funny. That's exactly how in the early parts of the book, you get the sense like this is like a kid with a mustache and a hat, kind of like he's got to walk the walk because he was talking so much shit.
Right.
And he's maybe like scared shitless underneath all that. You know what I mean? And then by the end, you get a sense of like, well, he's become the character now. Mm-hmm. And then that's when a little bit of the fun goes away. Once you fully become the guy that you were trying to be, it's like the story starts to wrap itself up.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, a lot of the people that I spoke to who had the most affection for him were women who I think he just may have let his guard down a little bit more around than the men around him.
Well, I think that's maybe a good place to stop it. I'm going to perform some songs next that were inspired by this. This is sort of grows out of like our similar musical taste too, because you've sort of introduced me to a lot. I think we have similar like denim rock touchstones.
Yes. Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this.
Yeah. And so much so that I actually referenced you in one of my songs where you're talking about the Force MDs, not this, but we're going to do a selection
very different kind of
70s sort of stoner novelty tunes to some degree. So let's give a hand to Sean Howe.
Thanks.
The copies of the book out front. Thanks, everybody. Let's take a minute or two to set up.
I'm Jason P. Woodbury. This has been Aquarium Drunkard Transmissions. I write, host, and produce the show. This episode was hosted by the great Will Sheff. Thanks so much to Will for sitting in the interview seat. I sure enjoyed listening to that. The episode was recorded by Sarah Alessandrini at PRS. Our music comes from Frank Mastin, and art for this episode was created by our friends at PRS. Our show's executive producer is Justin Gage, Aquarium Drunkard's founder. Don't miss his weekly radio program, The Aquarium Drunkard Show, on Sirius XMU, Channel 35 at 7 p.m. Pacific, each and every Wednesday night. If you're looking for a way to boost this show, consider sending this episode to a friend. You can also leave a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts, wherever you listen, but I care a lot less about those than I do about organic peer-to-peer passing along. Transmissions is part of the Talkhouse Podcast Network. Visit the Talkhouse for more interviews, fascinating reads, and podcasts. Next week on Transmissions, I'll be joined by Shabaka Hutchings of the incredible groups The Comet Is Coming. He was on the show with them back in the day. Of course, Shabaka and the Ancestors, Sons of Comet. But we're going to be discussing his new solo album, Perceive Its Beauty, Acknowledge Its Grace. It's really a really tremendous conversation. I had a great time speaking with him. So I hope you will come back and join us. In the meantime, remember, Aquarium Drunkard is supported by our subscribers. So head over to Aquarium Drunkard if you're into independent media and pledge your support. We sure appreciate it. Thank you for listening to this show. Be well until next week. This transmission is concluded.